In times of immense challenge requiring resilience and perseverance, who better to learn from than the U.S. Navy SEALs?
The basic principle I know I want to share with folks is to not avoid challenge, hardship, tough times, and to wade in head first so you prepare yourself for when really tough times come and you can't avoid it.
That's Commander Rourke Denver, who's led Navy SEAL Special Forces missions around the world. He's also run every phase of Navy SEAL training. Today, as founder of Ever Onward and a New York Times best-selling author, Rourke brings his experience as a SEAL to others around the world. As he shares in this conversation, the SEALs have developed a top-notch, high-performance culture designed to withstand situations that are truly life or death. SEAL teammates train, train again, and train some more, simulating experiences that are more intense than they would ever anticipate encountering in the field. Ultimately, when it comes down to it, SEAL teammates know they can rely on each other no matter what.
Make your training as real as you can to the real world experiences or challenges you're going to find. If you can, make them even harder.
I'm Merrill McDonald, and my passion is helping people and organizations navigate the human struggle of change. I believe that when we relinquish control, we open up amazing new possibilities. This podcast, Let Go and Lead, is about what happens when we loosen the reins. In it, I speak with business leaders, academics, and creative thinkers to hear about their career and life journeys and gather what they've learned about change, transformation, and creativity along the way. And now, Rourke Denver. So today we're here with Commander Rourke Denver. Rourke, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
I'm so interested in talking to you about your background with the Navy SEALs, and I know you've started a company called Ever Onward, which uses Navy SEAL principles and helps leaders. And so I'm really curious, starting with the Navy SEALs, I know that you're known for very strong embedded cultures. And your ethos, of course, is the line, by wearing the trident, I accept responsibility of my chosen profession and my way of life. It's a privilege I must earn every day. So it's not just a culture, it's a lifestyle.
Oh, 100%.
What is it about the foundation?
You know, it's interesting. You mentioned the ethos. That you know, kind of by the history of the SEAL teams is relatively new. You know, the SEAL teams were founded in the early 60s. John F. Kennedy saw a need for a kind of counterterrorism, very capable force that he wanted to draw from the naval ranks. And there are special operations across all the other divisions of the United States military, but the Navy didn't really have kind of its own team of special operators. Since he had a background in the Navy, he wanted to pull from those ranks to do so. And so, you know, in the early 60s, the SEALs were created. Vietnam was kind of our coming out party as far as the first combat engagements and the, you know, kind of reputation that the SEALs, our forefathers, built throughout those combat operations was bordering on mythical. And then the program just built and grew from there. We have a classic attrition rate of about 75 to 80% of the young lines that show up at SEAL training don't see the finish line. So only about 20 to 25% of the folks that try see the end and actually make it to the teams. So you have a very, very special group of folks, or certainly a very resilient, tough, kind of driven group of folks that make it to the teams. Then you get all the advanced training to prepare you for war. But it was only, it might even be less than 10 years ago that the community said, you know, we haven't really codified what we believe in, who we are, what we value, and let's put that down on paper. And I love literature and writing and history. And so the idea of writing down an ethos or understanding who you are and what you stand for certainly resonated with me. And so that document you read from is comparably new compared to other special operations units, but you definitely nailed it in the sense that it is an absolute all-in lifestyle. This is who you are. When you're doing the job, it's about as all-in as anything you can do. So yeah, the culture permeates from every individual operator, then throughout the ranks of the entire team. And what one person does ripples across the surface of all others.
What is it about the foundation of the culture that's made it so strong?
I think it's multifold, but I mean, I think one of the primary things, and sometimes this could sound repellent, although I think anybody that has done what I'll say next knows the merits of it. And it's just this unbelievable level of shared suffering that we basically pursue to kind of prepare ourselves and almost create an inoculation to hard times and suffering. So the program, you know, like I said, in selection of the SEALs is so unbelievably daunting and challenging for most folks that, you know, suffering kind of becomes the baseline. And when you get to this spot where you know the person on your team to your right, left, in front of you, behind you, at a minimum is never going to quit, is never going to give up no matter how hard the crucible is in front of you or the situation that's unfolding, that's a pretty great baseline, you know, for a high performing culture. If no one's ever going to give up or throw in the towel. And so that becomes, you know, really the foundation or kind of the bloodline of who we are. And then you build from that a tremendous amount of camaraderie, teamwork, creative thinking, tremendous respect for one another. You have the formula, the alchemy for tremendous high performance.
So this is a concept I think that's somewhat foreign to a lot of people in the corporate world. The idea, you know, I saw on your website the concept of aspire to suffer.
Right.
And you'd also talked about the crowd will avoid the pain, leaders will embrace it, but the greatest leaders seek it out. How does that relate to the corporate world?
Well, I think on the most basic level, I don't think many people, if they really kind of searched their life experience or frankly their souls, would not recognize or acknowledge and believe that those challenging and hard times we face in life is where the growth is and where the good lessons come from. When things are, you know, up on step, the boat's on plane, or things are going smooth in your life, albeit that can be enjoyable that things are working, I haven't felt that a lot of great lessons or growth or change opportunities take place in easy times. And boy, are we talking about a probably appropriate time for the nation and the world. When you're in challenging times, that generally is where you kind of come out of it and celebrate it and learn and kind of move forward. So in the corporate space, I think every industry, every culture, every company probably has a different way of looking at this. But the basic tenet and principle I think I want to share or that I know I want to share with folks is to not avoid challenge, hardship, tough times, and to wade in head first so you kind of prepare yourself for when really tough times come and you can't avoid it. And so that could be, you know, constructing some type of cultural experience where I've got some offerings that kind of, you know, offer this up where you'd say, hey, let's come do something challenging. Let's do some team building or challenging event to kind of bind us and give us some learning experiences that might be different from the others. In the most basic sense, if you don't seek it out, I would say, if nothing else, don't avoid the tough decisions, the tough conversations, the tough choices you're going to make about personnel and individuals with your organization, or the tough direction you might need if you know as a leader that the company or the organization needs to go. Don't run from those. You know, get after them, because it's almost certain you're going to be better for it as opposed to just letting things lie and hoping things work out.
Obviously, this is a very timely conversation. We're recording this podcast in the first week of April, so as we know, the world's in a very tough time right now. What are you seeing that would be really helpful for leaders to be thinking about at this moment?
You know, for leaders, we could do an entire separate conversation probably at some point on crisis leadership, and it's something that I lived, you know, my entire life, and my teammates lived our entire life in combat scenarios. Although you'd probably laugh. Never in combat, actually, with bullets flying or when teams were out operating in the battle space, when that was the case, is I feel like we had crisis. It was usually something back home that was much more pedestrian that we considered a crisis because we train and prepare for war and we go fight to win. So we're kind of comfortable in that zone. But when crisis unfolds, you need to do a couple things, and I'll keep them simple. But you need to, one, as a leader, one of my primary tenets is this concept of calm is contagious. And as a leader, if you can keep your head, set the example, obviously be seen and heard, you know, steering the ship and kind of being in that position of leadership and doing so in a calm, collected way, that generally permeates the organization. If the leader's losing their head, it's very rare that everyone else doesn't lose their head. So you got to stay calm. The next thing I'd do is build what we call your war room. You'd build your folks that have, you know, the greatest stake, you know, the stakeholders, your department heads, your division leaders, whatever that is. And then when it comes to building a war room, I want all the leadership there, but I also always want foot soldiers. I want somebody, you know, in the corporate space from the mailroom, somebody from HR, somebody from all the different areas. So you can really have, and I don't mean just the department head, somebody that's in the lowest level of your organization. I want in those meetings as well, because they're going to give you a very, very real look at what it's like for your troops, for kind of the regular folks within the organization. I think that's invaluable. Then it's communication, communicating at a rapid pace, but not at the pace of getting in front of information that could change quickly. Just keep it simple, be honest, give the good, the bad, and the ugly, and then get ready to move on. And then I'm huge proponent of making a call, making a decision. One of the only things we'll fire a junior officer for in the SEAL teams, when we're particularly teaching them how to be a gunfighter, how to be a combat operator, is if they do nothing. So if we throw a challenge in front of them, they don't say something, they freeze, they don't make a call, that's kind of terms for your removal. We would much rather see somebody make a bold call, even if it wasn't the perfect call, and then do so with, you know, aggression and confidence and intensity, than make no call at all. So I think making a call fast, as opposed to waiting for it to be perfect, is hugely, hugely important.
Those are all really great examples. Thank you. With the SEAL culture, I know it's a mindset, as we talked about, as well as a culture. And I heard somewhere that you actually train for the culture. How do you train for a culture?
I think it's right that it's two separate things, but I think they feed off each other. They're certainly not separate in, you know, kind of being different silos. I think it's multifold. I think our basic program, as described earlier, puts so much challenge on the plate of a young person trying to enter the ranks of our community and culture, that you're going to get a pretty tough, resilient, focused, driven individual to the SEAL team. Then when you show up with the SEAL team, the mindset is great, because it's just driven down and the example is set every day from almost always the most senior leader down to the most junior personnel. I mean, you show up for even a daily workout. Like, I went to my first SEAL team on the East Coast out in Virginia Beach in the Chesapeake Bay. You know, I show up there in late fall. So one of the first, you know, ocean swims that we just did as a team, just one of our morning workouts, you know, is in Chesapeake Bay in February. I mean, when you hit that water, even with your wetsuit on, it feels like your teeth are going to explode. The water's so cold. You feel like you're swimming through slush. And what you realize is, you know, while there's some, you know, kind of classic Navy military complaining and maybe, you know, dragging your heels for a second heading into the swim, everybody goes. No one, you know, decides to skip that day of training. And when we get out of the water, there's this shared level of camaraderie that we all did something hard that day that just kind of waters and maintains that wellspring of kind of toughness and the way we see the world. And so when you see, you know, the senior leader, the C-suite executive, which in our line would be the commanding officer and the command mass chief, the senior enlisted advisor, and then the most junior person, the team, all doing that together, well, you just kind of recognize that this is who we are. This is what the mindset is. We're going to stay the course and fight to the last breath in everything we do. It's pretty easy to, easy is not the right word, but it's much easier to maintain that when everybody's all in, compared to trying to create a culture that could be coming out of something toxic or different. So it really is one of those things we do from the top to the bottom, almost in every day.
And, you know, what you're alluding to here, of course, is a commitment to your mental fitness as well as your physical fitness.
100%.
How do you think about that in terms of resiliency? Like, can you train for resiliency?
I sure think you can. And something you said that really keys me into a concept, this idea of not actually separating those two. When you talk about, you know, the physical fitness and the mental fitness, I really feel those go hand in hand. So I think that's actually one of the real secrets of special operators, both in the military and beyond, is that coupling of mental and physical fitness at all times. And if you can do both, I think they very much build on each other and feed on each other. So we don't decouple those from one another. We take that very seriously, that our physical fitness is going to feed the mental and vice versa. That said, when somebody asked me, is getting through SEAL training more mental or physical, we say it's easily 90-10 mental to physical. If your mind and your spirit is focused on performing at a high level, it can drive basically everything else in your body and kind of your ecosystem to meet with success, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. I'm just curious, how do you actually train for that?
Well, we do it mostly through exceptionally kind of realistic and visceral training. So everything we do that we train for on the battlefield, and granted, our job is not a normal job when your primary focus is preparing for, you know, deadly combat, force on force engagements in austere locations around the world. That's obviously a very unique discipline to train for. But what I'll say next, ripples or would be, you know, equally effective if you're working at a fast food restaurant, a hedge fund, or any other business, is that make your training as real as you can to the real world experiences or challenges you're going to find. If you can, make them even harder. I mean, if you're at some business where, let's say, a really tough time becomes a 10-hour day, like all of a sudden you went from your regular work day to a 10-hour, a 12-hour day, I'd put something in there where when it's not intense throughout the workflow or the work cycle, where we did 14, 16, 18-hour days for a little while, because then you kind of prepare yourself beyond what you're probably going to expect in the real world. I think if you were in a job and the hardest thing that you could be asked to do in that job is something you've never experienced or practiced for, good luck. I mean, I hope you rise to the occasion. What I've generally seen is people kind of degrade to their level of training as opposed to rising to the occasion. So we want to make sure our training goes beyond what we'll be required to do. And if you do that in any job, you go beyond what you'll probably see in the actual real environment, well, then the real environment's going to be a whole lot easier.
So how do you think this philosophy is coming to light right now in the situation that we're currently seeing, with people sheltering in place, all the challenges that they're having?
One of the first times I was getting tested by my commanding officer, we had a boat operation. We were coming from the sea to the shore to hit a target. And he asked us to go 15 miles out in these small boats to come in and hit the target. And when we came back, he said, "What'd you learn?" And we gave him the X's and O's, what we done, the gas consumption we used, all the different things that we kind of learned on the mission. And he said, "Is that it?" And I said, "Yeah, I think so." He said, "Great, go do it again tonight and do it at 30 miles out." So we doubled our distance. So we go out, we do it at 30 miles, we come back in. My buddy and I, that we were both like leading the operation, get back, same success, same event. It just took us longer to get to the target. We get to the debrief with the commanding officer, and he says, "Great, what'd you learn?" We do the exact same thing. We give him all the X's and O's, the basic things that happened. We knew he was looking for something, but we didn't know exactly what it was. And so he gets to the end, and he says, "What'd you learn?" And both of us are looking at each other like, "Oh man, we haven't said it yet." He said, "Great, go do it at 75 miles. So now the same evolution we've done at 15, 30, now at 75, approaching 100 miles out. Now we need to use a separate set of boats. We need to like triple our gas. I mean, there's all kinds of things that we have to now build onto the process that made it more complex. And I remember when we're about halfway through the operation, just something in the back of my mind said, "Man, oh man, was 30 miles and 15 easy compared to 75 miles. And then it kind of hit me like a lightning bolt. We sat down at that debrief. My buddy that was sitting with me, I kind of kept it close to the vest because I was hoping to, you know, impress the commanding officer. But he asked us again. He said, "Hey, you know, what'd you learn?" And I said, "Well, I'm not sure if this is the right thing, but I know for a fact 15 miles and in looks so easy now compared to 75 miles, I can't even wrap my head around it." And he had a big smile come across his face. He said, "Great, you're done with that evolution. Let's move on to the next one." And it really just was this idea of kind of moving my mental time horizon to a different, further out place so that everything within inside that makes it easier. So I did a post about a week ago that I kind of talked about this to the civilian world. And I said, "Look," and this was early. This is early when things started here. You know, we're talking April right now. This was probably 2-3 weeks ago. And I said, if your mental state right now at home with your kids, your family, or where you're living right now is, this is probably going to be over in 2 weeks or 2 months, I would seriously move that time horizon way further out. Why don't you just put it at 2 years? I absolutely hope and will be the first one to celebrate that if it's over in 2 months or we've gotten past it and can get back to regular life, that that'd be better. But if I put it at 2 years in my mind, then anything short of that, any resolution in between now and that 2 years, well, then it becomes something to celebrate for me. As uncomfortable as that can be, it's going to let you breathe a little easier, as opposed to making it very short and kind of this desire for it to resolve quicker. It just kind of resets your kind of internal clock and your mindset to, I think, prepare yourself for a longer duration than a shorter duration.
I'm just absorbing that. That's really interesting. And I think such great advice.
Oh, I appreciate it.
Yeah. And, you know, as you talked about the whole fact that leadership is contagious, you talked about calm being contagious.
Yes.
Can you just talk a little bit more about that? Because I so agree with it.
Yeah. People ask me a lot, what's the number one thing I learned in training as a SEAL? And of course, they're going to expect that it's some hand-to-hand fighting move or some weapon system I can use. And that's not the number one thing. Those are important. And we master those and kind of develop those to a high level performance so we can do it well on the battlefield. But it really is the mental state and the mindset that we take into the fight that has been the most valuable thing I've learned. And that lesson, calm is contagious, came from a real senior SEAL, you know, what's called a command master chief, the most senior enlisted person in the United States Navy, is a master chief petty officer. And I remember in a training scenario, one of the senior officers, a guy that was in charge of me, was kind of losing his cool. I mean, he was just yelling and kind of screaming. You could tell he'd sort of lost the leadership bubble and the ability to kind of maintain a level of discipline and focus. And this master chief kind of pulled all the leaders in, him included, and said, hey, if you lose it, you know, the troops, your team, at a minimum, are going to mimic your behavior. They're going to mimic what you do as a leader. And they might do more than that, which is amplify your behavior. They're going to do more of what you do because they want to meet your expectations. So if you keep calm, they'll keep calm. If you lose it, they're probably going to lose it. And then he said that singular line, calm is contagious. Calm is contagious. And it just never left me. That was right at the beginning of my career. And it occurred to me that if I ever panicked or started falling apart, that would be in no way an advantage to myself or my team. And I've tested it under pretty dire circumstances, and I've never seen it proven false. I've never seen anybody keep their head in a bad scenario where they didn't maintain or make it better. And I've never seen anybody lose their head. And I've seen that too, and not seen things just go off the tracks. And again, this kind of goes back to that concept of preparing yourself and doing hard things so you're ready for hard things. You know, I don't think you can say, hey, I'm going to stay calm no matter what the scenario, if you haven't put yourself through tough scenarios.
Yeah, I think the other interesting thing about being calm is when you just think of the neuroscience, of course, until you can calm yourself, you can't even access your full processing capability to think.
100%. And we do breathing and kind of tactical exercises to, you know, take those deep breaths, maybe do a big breath in, hold it for a few seconds, big exhale out, hold it for a few seconds. About 4 iterations of that, you can drop 20, 30 points of your heartbeat. And exactly as you said, reaccess all the parts of your brain that are going to let you make good decisions that shut down when you go into that flight type mental status and scenario. And you just cannot perform at a high level when you're doing that.
You know, I'm just thinking about how you have such a community of high performing individuals and you're bringing all these learnings now to your clients. So what do you think it takes to lead a group of such high performers?
Well, I think there's something that I've kind of found about leadership that I think is fascinating is I love leadership. I love studying leadership. I've probably forgotten more books than I've read on leadership than a lot of people will read, although I'm preaching to the choir to somebody that thinks a lot about it and works with high impact leaders around the world. So I know you know this stuff, but it's one of those interesting things where every once in a while I'll have a client ask me about what leadership style they think or I think they should adopt. And I'll stop them immediately and say, do not even think about trying to do that. The thing you need to do as a leader is be the best version of a leader that you are. I think you can pretend to be a servant leader. And if that's not who you are, it's going to fall dishonest or inauthentic. And I think the best thing any leader can do is be authentic. So I've seen it all in the military. I mean, I've seen leaders that were kind of screaming tyrants that you would not want to work for, but they actually had fantastic judgment. They knew how to make good decisions. And while it wasn't a lot of fun to work for them, they were exceptional leaders. And I saw cerebral leaders that were quiet and reserved and much more deliberate in the way they did things. And I saw them succeed as well. And then I saw the opposite. I saw tyrants that were screamers that no one wanted to be around and they were a disaster, and cerebral leaders that were kind of in that same place. So if you take every type of leadership you could pull off a bookshelf at Barnes and Noble or from, you know, a library, I think, read it like it's a horoscope and find the one that kind of is who you are naturally and be the best version of that. There's always non-negotiables. I mean, you got to take care of your folks. You have to set the example. You cannot ask them to do something that you're not willing to do, at least, you know, authentically in who you're going to do for them. I think one of the big things leaders miss, or some leaders miss, is that the higher you go up the leadership structure, the higher you go up the chain of command, does not mean now more people work for you. It means you now work for more people. And if you figured out that you serve those that you're technically in charge of, that team will do anything for you.
So those are some of the things, you know, as you started to summarize, that are things that really strong leaders have in common. And as you said, regardless of their style, right? So we just mentioned taking care of people, setting an example, don't ask people to do what you wouldn't, you know, remember you work for them, they don't work for you. Anything else that our listeners should be thinking about?
Yeah, I think also recognizing that being a leader is the toughest choice within an organization. It just is the toughest choice. And I think some people that are further down the ladder might think and roll their eyes and be like, oh, well, the leaders have it easy. I've sat in those seats and they're hot seats. Even when things are going well, there's usually some fire within an organization that you're responsible for, you should be responsible for. So I think the other thing you got to do is just have tremendous confidence. I think you need to have a borderline irrational belief in yourself. And that, whether it's genuine or you fake it, would serve you well, just to believe and trust yourself that you're doing the right thing. You're on an island a lot. Even if you have a leadership team, a board of directors, a great advisory crew, in the end, the true leader, the senior leader, is on an island, and they're going to have to make decisions for the organization. And look, now more than ever, I mean, you know this well, there's a whole bunch of leaders right now that are making some of the toughest decisions most likely they'll ever see in an organization, furloughing the entire staff, letting people go, knowing that they have probably employees that live paycheck to paycheck and they can't pay it regardless of the infusion of cash from the government or whatever it might be. And you've got to be honest and also recognize that that's the price of your position. And you got to make those tough choices as best you can within the framework of what am I doing to support and maintain this organization? And what do I need to do to have the tough conversation, make the tough decisions to see that thing comes out the other end. In the end, if you don't make those hard decisions and the organization actually fails or go away, well, then you didn't create anything that could come back and then provide the very jobs it was providing before you took that hit. So I think believing in yourself, trusting yourself, making the best decision you can across, you know, kind of moral, ethical compass lines, but also making those hard decisions is what you get paid for. That's what leaders are there for. And it's not easy. You'll suffer tremendous slings and arrows for sure.
Given that, the title of our podcast, of course, is Let Go and Lead. What do you think leaders need to let go of?
I think leaders need to let go of sometimes the results or the feel of their decisions. I mean, I had one leader I remember that very senior leader in organization. I was a real junior advisor, that leader. And he was one of those leaders where a bunch of competing entities would come in the room. So let's say, you know, three commanding officers come into the office to try and get, let's say, a lion's share of a budget for them to, you know, run their team and run their job. This leader that I worked for, and it was lucky because I did a junior in my life, was kind of one of those guys that really wanted to be liked. He never wanted to make a tough call. And consequently, everybody would leave that meeting thinking they got what they wanted. And there was, I could do the math. There were not enough resources for that to be the case. And I even had a real honest conversation very, very respectfully, because he was senior and I was super junior. But I said, you know, boss, I think you're supposed to have two or three people lead that meeting feeling like they got, you know, kind of the shaft, and the one or two got the gold or what they deserve to move forward, because there's just not enough in the till to get everybody what they want. I mean, I think that's the decision that needs to be made. And we went back and forth about it. I don't think he was self-aware that he kind of did that. But I think I, in my career moving forward from that, said, I know I'm going to disappoint and potentially in some aspects disappoint more people than I'm going to make happy, but I still need to be okay that is my job. That's what I get paid for. And if you want to talk about the ultimate of that, the end state of the job of a SEAL tactical operator could very much end in decisions you make costing someone their life. Now, you hope no singular decision you make truly costs one individual their life, but I had, I can't tell you, I lost count of how many funerals I've been to for teammates and SEALs that paid the ultimate price on the battlefield. And if you're the type of leader that can't digest that the decisions you're making and what you're doing on the battlefield could end with that, and yet we all went into it with our eyes open, and that is going to be the price of this job, you're not going to last long in our organization. Now, I think most leaders will not have the end state decisions of their choices lead to the life and death of those folks they lead. But sometimes it's not far off with their welfare and their future and their, you know, ability to survive in this world. And I think it's one of those gifts you give yourself when you can give yourself a little bit of grace and a little bit of breathing room that you need to make the tough decision that's probably going to cost people dearly and help others differently. And you better be able to digest that, let it go at the end of every night, and get ready to do it again the next day, or you're just going to be in a tortured seat.
That's really timely advice for sure. And, you know, when you started this, you described it as letting go of the results or the feeling of the decisions, or that's what I thought I heard.
Yeah.
Can you just put a finer point on that?
Yeah, I think sometimes, you know, people get so wrapped up with making the right decision, the perfect decision, they make no decision. And you just got to recognize, as a leader, you have to make these tough calls with the best information, the best judgment you have in the moment. And then once you've let that go, you've got to truly let it go. It reminds me a little bit of teaching people to shoot. So SEALs are really well known for, you know, accuracy with pistol, rifle, all the different weapon systems we use. And while there's all these skills you need to do to shoot effectively, stance, trigger control, posture, follow through, all these, I could name, you know, 10, 15 different things you need to do well on a pistol or rifle to make that bullet go where you want it to go. One of the bigger things I wanted to teach my operators, my shooters, that I thought was more important than even the X's and O's of how to shoot a gun well, because I could teach an orangutan how to do that, is I wanted to tell them, hey, just remember, when you pull the trigger and that bullet leaves the barrel, leaves the chamber, you don't get to take it back. That bullet is going to go where it's going to go, and it's going to do the damage it's going to do. You better be sure you made a good call when you release that bullet, when you release that round into the world, because once it leaves, you ain't getting it back. So I think it's very similar in decision-making and leadership, where make your call. Once that bullet is out of the chamber, you've done what you need to do to control it.
Terrific. Well, this has been absolutely fantastic. I so appreciate your time.
No, I enjoyed the conversation. Thanks for having me. I really, really enjoyed it.
Wow, what incredible learnings from such a revered organization. Here are my top learnings from Rourke. First, the way you lead is likely to be mimicked or even amplified by those around you. For example, remember that calm is contagious. Your team will follow your energy. Second, don't wait for things to be perfect to make a decision. Making an imperfect call is better than making no call at all. Third, push yourself to develop, simulate, and train for situations beyond what you think you'll ever experience. If you push yourself beyond your actual environment will become a whole lot more manageable. Fourth, move your mental time horizon. If you're enduring challenges that should resolve within a year, what would you do if they continue for two? Or if you anticipate closing a big deal in 6 months, what would you do now if it was closing in 6 weeks? As uncomfortable as it can be, this tactic helps reset your internal clock and your mindset. Lastly, many of us think that the higher we get in our job, the more people will work for us. It's the opposite. The higher you get, the more you work for more people. Figure out how to serve them, and those people will have your back. Thank you again to Rourke for the fantastic conversation and learnings. If you enjoyed today's episode, please remember to subscribe or share this episode with a colleague or friend. I appreciate this community so much. Thanks for tuning in to Let Go and Lead.